Not sure whether you noticed or not. Sign went up just as Doug started to pray that grades 1 to 6 can be dismissed today, which is unusual. So if you didn't see it, your grades 1 to 6, you can fire out there now, and that would be great. I want to let you know how good it is to be back in the saddle this week. God granted Melanie and I a great vacation. Times of activity, quiet and peace, thankfully, of work, great mix of travel and staying put, and the refreshing of God through much of it. And so if you prayed for that, I want to thank you and also affirm that God answered your prayers, often in abundance. The last Sunday that we were here in July, before we took a break, we had a baby dedication. And I looked at Proverbs as an inspired compendium of wisdom that we ourselves can live by and then pass on to our children as we seek to parent them. And I looked exclusively at financial wisdom as seen in the book of Proverbs to live ourselves and pass on. Today, more baby dedications. I would like to continue to look at the book of Proverbs and again look at wisdom that we can learn and live ourselves and then pass on to others. This time, not in the area of finances, but I'm going to tread lightly into the area of sex and sexuality. You may have been surprised that there was children's programming today for grades 1 to 6, and it's in part because of the subject matter, not because it's lewd, but because it may be pointed and needs to be clear. But up front, let me tell you the reason why I believe that parents need to get their heads out of the sand if they are in fact in there and get serious about this matter of sexual purity, both within themselves and within their children. Perhaps you've heard the rage of late over the book 50 Shades of Grey, which has now become a trilogy. I haven't read it, but I've read plenty about it, including the plot. And without unrolling the sordid plot line, suffice it to say that it has been popularly labeled as mummy porn. Entry-level porn that might appeal to mothers who were dissatisfied with their sex lives or those who enjoy reading romance novels and want to take the next step forward from there, or backward, I suppose. And yet it's not just mums that read it. Both genders have read it. I saw 5 people on vacation reading it, and 2 of them were men. Furthermore, the fact that it made it to number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list tells me a lot about people's attitudes towards sex and sexuality. I only read one review of the book that included the plot, but was especially interested in the blogging that followed, because it's there in the blog that you get people's attitudes and thoughts. One thing that was odd, I guess, maybe it wasn't funny, but I found it funny. Most of the comments given were given by a person named Anonymous in the blog. But what I found aside from that was that, aside from rants about repeated dialogue that got boring and maybe some poor writing style, there was no outcry whatsoever about the behavior or the plot that is sexually immoral times 2, at least according to any biblical standards. Maybe Christians don't blog. Maybe they didn't read the book or stopped partway through and couldn't comment. But to the extent of its popularity that was endorsed on the one hand and the lack of moral outcry on the other hand, that combined made a huge statement to me. And then Mel sent me an article about a hotel in England's Lake District called the Damson Denny Hotel, whose owner, Jonathan Denby, replaced the Gideon Bible in the drawer side table with 50 Shades of Grey. Ironically, he bought the hotel a decade ago from the Methodists, and since that time had been trying to figure out what to replace the Bible with. He says, and I quote, subtly acknowledging the racy contents, "Because everyone is reading it, we thought it would be the hospitable thing to do to have this available for our guests, especially if some were a little shy about buying it because of its reputation. Sexual immorality and perversion, as biblically defined, has gone mainstream and has become a huge hit. But if we were to throw away 50 Shades of Grey and take the Bible, the Gideon Bible, out of the drawer and look at it for wisdom on sexually appropriate and God-honoring behavior imperative to our lives and to pass on to our kids, what would that wisdom be? More specifically, what wisdom does the book of Proverbs give us in terms of handling our own sex and sexuality and give us as to what we ought to pass on to our children? And what you'll find in the book of Proverbs, if you read through the whole thing, is you'll find five ploys that are used by those who want to seduce the sexually unaware. Three responses to those kinds of illicit unions outside of marriage. And then four responses that we can make ourselves and have our children make so that this does not happen to them. Five ploys, three results, and four responses. But before we look at this, I would like to just quickly look at three sidebars. I suppose that it shouldn't be surprising that a lot of this wisdom comes in the form of warnings and prohibitions. Don't do this. Watch out for that. To a secular crowd who don't want to be told what they can or cannot do, such warnings seem prudish and confining and archaic. But to one whose horizon is long-term, these limits and prohibitions are not prudish at all. The second sidebar is that you will find that the sexual wisdom that Solomon shares is heterosexual in nature. Homosexuality is dealt with elsewhere in the Bible, so this is all heterosexual stuff. And the wisdom that is shared from Solomon to his son is therefore talking about certain kinds of women. But be that the case, you need to keep in mind that through it all, Solomon is not picking on women. But because he is a man giving his son advice, he is talking about certain kinds of women. Naturally, you would have to. But what is true of women who ought to be warned against is also true of men who need to be warned against. So how would such a person who would desire to lead you into sexual sin behave? How would they operate? In other words, what ploys should we train ourselves and then train our children to watch for and guard against from the opposite gender? Solomon shows us five techniques that a seducer will use. The first ploy is flattery. Flattery. Most of the material that I'm going to get come from the first five chapters of Proverbs. If you wanted to flip, you could, but pretty much the first five chapters. The second line of Proverbs 2, verse 16 speaks of the adulteress who flatters with her words. Fascinating word in Hebrew. That same word used for flatter is used to speak of young David as he reaches down into the brook looking for stones to kill Goliath with, and he says that he happened on five smooth stones. Same word. In other words, a flattering person is a smooth talker. Proverbs chapter 5, verse 5 says of an immoral woman, smoother than oil is her speech. A sweet talker, a smooth talker. And this smooth talk has two intentions. The first comes from the understanding that the essence of flattery is to put another in a more favorable light than is really true. Okay? It ignores the similarity between people, and we're pretty much all alike. Very few of us are outstanding, and says something like this: you have the most beautiful eyes I have ever seen. Now, if you put that in an objective light, it would make you think, or perhaps even say out loud, well, I guess you haven't looked in many eyes in your life, have you? Right? You have the warmest smile on earth. Really? When was the last time you saw someone smile from Bangladesh? Right? That's objective. But sometimes, rather than thinking of this statement objectively, our desire to be desired, our desire to be thought of as handsome or beautiful or hot, can lead us to take that exaggerated statement to be absolutely true, which is the speaker's intent. Because the second sense that flattery carries with it is not only to smooth talk, but it is to deceive the hearer into believing that what you say is in fact true. So what do we do? Well, have an honest appraisal of yourself, an objective appraisal of yourself. Teach your children to do the same, and it will help shield you from the effects of a flatterer who is exaggerating. Flatterer who has much more in mind for you than what they're letting on. The first ploy used, the first thing to teach your children to guard against, is flattery. And yet those who would try to draw you into sexual immorality will seldom use flattery alone. The second ploy they may use, as innocent as it may sound, is a shared meal. In chapter 7, verse 14, the woman says to the man there, "I was due to offer peace offerings, and today I have paid my vows." You read that in the context of seduction and you wonder if she has lost her marbles. What does this have to do with anything? Well, what is likely is that she is talking about having offered up a peace offering either to Jehovah God or to another god, and as a part of that whole sacrificial procedure, you get some of the meat back. And whether we're talking about being Jewish or any other religious system, that meat is only good for one day, after which it is considered to be defiled or impure. So what she is in essence saying is, "Would you like to share a meal with me? I have food prepared at home. Would you like to come there with me?" And that's not just a way to get him into her house, but I have said before that taste is the most intimate of the five senses. Sharing a meal together is one of the most intimate experiences, although we take it for granted. The appeal to taste. No surprise then, at the beginning of the encounter, it says, verse 13, that she seizes him and kisses him. In an attempt to seduce you or your children, others will use flirtatious words and will appeal to the sense of taste to break through your defenses. You need to know that. Remember that. Tell your children about that. And again, taste is not the only sense that is appealed to by one schooled in the art of seduction. They also appeal to the sense of sight, visual appeal. Still in chapter 7, verse 16, she says to him, "I have spread my couch with coverings, with colorful linens of Egypt." Now, I want you to know that the couch is not physically there. Okay? So what's going on here is imagined sight. And if you're familiar at all with the imagination, you know that it easily and naturally takes what is said and exaggerates it. That's why control your imagination is just a phrase that is natural to use. So what a forward and seductive woman might say is, "I have this sort of clothing in my bedroom. My bed is kind of like this." And what it does is it lights the visual fire, the fire of the imagination in the man who is with her. And it just goes wild. It's imagined sight. But then there's also actual sight. Verse 10 says that this woman is dressed like a harlot. Visual. Studies used to say that men were fired up by what they saw, but women were not. And men are fired up by what they see. But what recent studies have shown is that both genders are now almost equally susceptible to visual stimulation like that, which means quite a few things. One is that you need to watch the way you dress and instruct your children to dress. Pay attention to what you allow them to wear. For women, plunging necklines and skirts that are too short, clothing that is too tight in the right places is wrong. Mothers should model and caution their daughters as to how they dress. Fathers need to warn their sons as to how they're visually wired and help them to avoid situations where they may end up staring and using their imaginations inappropriately. And also instruct them on what they are not to wear. Clothes that are not too tight or revealing or provocative. Visual appeal, whether real or imagined, used in order to seduce. The third sense that a seducer will appeal to is touch. The woman has already kissed the man in Proverbs 7. But then she says in verse 18, "Come, let us drink our fill of love until morning. Let us delight ourselves with caresses. Beware yourselves and teach your children to beware of sexually motivated touch. The touch of a hand, the brush of a cheek, hand through the hair, sliding an arm through yours, arm around the waist, those sorts of things. Hugs can be some of the greatest things on earth, I understand. They can also be unwholesome. And you should be able to tell right away that something is wrong if you're discerning. It's too long. Head is turned in, towards lips towards your neck. It's too tight. There's movement that shouldn't be happening. Unnecessary areas touching. It's all the appeal to touch in order to seduce. And finally, one who would sexually seduce will make use of the sense of smell. The woman in our scene says, "I have sprinkled my bed with myrrh and aloes and cinnamon." All of these spices have a smell that is intended to delight. And there is a multi-million, maybe even billion-dollar industry for products whose smell are designed to help seduce the opposite gender. You can see it in the perfume commercials on television, even chewing gum. The worst are the Axe body wash commercials. All of them are built on the premise that the right smell attracts and arouses the opposite gender, because to a certain degree it is absolutely true. I'm not saying you refuse deodorant from now on. Ban your children from wearing it. That is not a sign of being chaste in our culture. In fact, it's rude and offensive and inconsiderate of other people. What I am saying is that you need to be aware of what fragrances you are wearing, why you are wearing them, and for whom you wear them. And teach your children that. Teach them to understand the power of scent to lower their sexual inhibitions. Well, a girl in our situation here has success in her use of flattery and visual appeal and sharing a meal and touch and smell. And she gets a guy to go home with her. Just like hundreds, or during Stampede Week, even thousands of men and women do every day in Calgary. Chapter 7, verse 21 says, "With her many persuasions, she entices him. With flattering lips, she seduces him." And yet, what is the end of it all? What does wisdom, which has stood the test of time, say will happen to that kind of a union outside of the bonds of marriage? And Solomon gives us three results of intimacy outside of marriage. And I'd like to show them to you in a way that I think they grow in severity, If there's any doubt about the wrongness and the painful results of intimacy outside of the bonds of marriage, you only need to look at Proverbs chapter 6, where Solomon says to his son, "Do not desire another's beauty, and do not let her catch your eye." And then he gives reasons. One reason, actually. One reason by asking two questions. The answer to both of them is no. He asks, "Can a man take fire in his bosom and his clothes not be burned?" No. "Or can a man walk on hot coals and his feet not be scorched?" No. Obviously, sexual intimacy outside of marriage is something forbidden. And furthermore, he's saying the results are painful. Burn like fire. Let me show you some of the results just from Proverbs. The first is down a few verses into chapter 6, verse 23, which basically says that the sexually immoral will find wounds and disgrace, and his reproach will not be blotted out. What this speaks of is loss of trust and reputation that could be permanent. Loss of trust and reputation that could be permanent. Everywhere you go, people know or learn of the indiscretion. They may not talk to you because they don't know what to say or don't want to say what they are thinking. On the other hand, they may just let loose and say things that are judging and unkind. You may find that you are excluded or have to exclude yourselves from things you used to do. And people can appear gracious while never forgetting an indiscretion of this nature. It's sad, but it's true. So one of the results of sexual intimacy outside of marriage is loss of reputation and trust. It could be permanent. The second loss is financial in nature. In Proverbs chapter 5, verse 10, Solomon again warns against explicit moral relationship, this time saying, "Don't do it lest strangers be filled with your strength and your hard-earned goods go to the house of an alien." Chapter 6, verse 26 carries much the same notion. It says, "You will be reduced to a loaf of bread." And what he's talking about is financial ruin. He could may well mean that you end up supporting this other man or woman. He may well mean that you have to pay them in order to keep quiet. That the child that is conceived that night will be have to be in your financial care for the rest of your life. Today, he could mean that the divorce that results, you would be the offending party and could lose everything. A loss of trust and reputation that could be permanent, and financial ruin. Then, as we see the final result of ramped up results, Solomon says that another result of sexual union outside of marriage could even be a form of death. Chapter 2, verses 18 and 19 say of the seductive woman, "And her house sinks down to death. Her tracks lead to the dead. None who go to her return again, nor do they reach the paths of life." Sexual relations outside of marriage lead to a form of death. I'm not sure whether what Solomon is referring to is literal death, like an early grave or death by disease or being murdered by a jealous spouse or perhaps being stoned to death according to the Old Testament law back then, or whether it's more figurative, death coming in the form of regret or guilt that steal life from you and destroy your spirit, taking the vitality out of living and just leaving you as a husk with this nagging sense of full-blown regret. Either way, one result of such a union is a form of death. And so we ought to ask, how should we respond given what we've been reminded of or learned, looked at today? How should we as people respond to this? How should some of us as parents respond to this? And I believe that Proverbs gives us at least four ways in which we can respond to this. The first piece of wisdom is this: to inform and remind ourselves and our children of the results of such sexual unions. Inform ourselves and remind ourselves and inform our children and remind our children of the results. I say that because I was surprised that those that Solomon talked about as having sinned didn't know any better. For example, referring to such intimacy, he writes in chapter 9, verse 17, he says, "Stolen water is sweet. Bread eaten in secret is pleasant." So he's not denying the pleasure factor of secret sinful sexual union. But then he says, but he does not know that the dead are there and her guests are in the depths of Sheol. Ignorance of results. Even stronger is chapter 7, verses 22 and 23, where Solomon says of the man who follows the seductress, like an ox led to the slaughter, he does not know that it will cost him his life. Some people don't know any better. And a segment of them don't want to be told either, because they think that they're having too much fun. The man or woman who would serve Christ needs to remind themselves and their children of the results of sinful, immoral unions. And in our sex-charged culture, reminders of this sort need to be frequent and imperative. That's the first response. The second one is to rein in our desires. Proverbs 6, verse 23 advises, Solomon advises his son, "Do not desire her beauty in your heart." Much of sexual sin starts in the mind, in the heart, right? Looking, liking, lusting, fantasizing. And the more time that is spent desiring like this, the better the chance is that desire will override your understanding and the commitments that you have made, and you end up falling. Rein in your desires. Refuse to stare. Refuse to fantasize. Avoid all incidents of physical contact with someone who makes you struggle. You stay away from them as a means to rein in desires. The third is for those who are married. It is to find satisfaction in your mate. Find satisfaction in your mate. Solomon's advice to his son in chapter 5, verse 19 is this: "As a loving hind and a graceful doe, let her breast satisfy you at all times. Be exhilarated always with her love. Find sexual fulfillment in your partner's body." And the way that Solomon states this gives us two insights. The first is this, and it's that it is a choice. When he says, "Let her satisfy you, let him satisfy," that is a choice that you make. Be exhilarated always with his or her love. To be exhilarated is a choice that you make. Therefore, rather than thinking or dreaming that another might be more exciting, be excited with and choose to be excited with and by your mate. Solomon concludes that enjoyment is there if you choose it. He said, because he says, "Let him or her satisfy you," what he is saying is that such satisfaction is possible. When he says, "Be exhilarated with him or her," he says it because it can happen. And what's really interesting to me, he says, "Be exhilarated with her." And then in the next verse, he asks the question, "For why should you, my son, be exhilarated with an adulteress?" The reason that this caught my attention is because I almost expected him to ask, "For why should you, my son, be more exhilarated with an adulteress?" No. He's saying that the pleasure level with another need be no higher than the pleasure level with your spouse if you choose that, if you work on that for a lifetime. Final response to what we've seen this morning is to raise your horizon from the immediate to the long term. I rode in a couple of float planes this summer, once in the co-pilot's seat. This was horribly uncomfortable. Legs are too long, and I kept touching the pedals, and the steering wheel kept banging my knees, so I don't want to fly. But I noticed how much of the pilot's focus was on the horizon ahead, rather than on what was immediately in front of him. To set his focus on what was right in front of him would mean an immediate lowering of the nose of the plane. And if that were maintained, we would have crashed. Now the horizon, long term. I remember someone telling me once that lust makes God unreal and collapses all time into the immediate. And in the immediate, all that you care about is what will happen in the next hour or hours, not the results that could in fact last a lifetime. Speaking of not being tempted, Solomon tells his son, let your eyes look directly ahead. Let your gaze be fixed ahead. Watch the path for your feet, not of your feet, which is a long-term perspective. The horizon, what will this mean 10, 20 years from now? And added to this horizon, remember that the eyes of God are on you. They're on the edge of the horizon, and He is watching. Proverbs 5:21, again within the context of this sexual business, says, the ways of a man are before the eyes of the Lord, and He watches all of his paths. In George Orwell's famous book, 1984, Big Brother was always watching. But the purpose of his watching was to maintain totalitarian control of this nation. The eyes of God are watching not just to chide, but to cheer as we live sexually in keeping with the way that He created us to live, to love, and be happy in. The Apostle Paul tells us that in the latter days men will become lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, which should tell us that as time ticks on, the pressure towards sexual sin will ramp up. And what that does is it creates within us a need for ever more vigilance with our lives and in the lives of our kids. Allow me to pray for us to that end. Please bow. Father, we thank You today for the gift of sex and sexuality that You created for us to enjoy. We acknowledge that You have set boundaries around it and around us to protect us and what You have created so that it remains good. Satan has been attacking what You have created and is doing so increasingly and will continue to do so increasingly. And so I ask, dear Father, that You would guard our hearts and our minds from thoughts that could lead us to sin. That You would grant us the will to say no when You would have us do that. The will to wait until marriage, and the will to work on a lifetime of enjoyment of this, Your gift to us. For I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.